I want to welcome everybody to the kickoff of our Pesach series, and a pleasure to bring back Rabbi Avram Kowalski, a creative, original thinker. We're giving a three-part series, beginning with Yosef and his dreams, parts, situations in Tanakh Paro, the 10 plagues, so for the next three Mondays at 11 a.m., 5 p.m. Next week, it'll be 6 p.m. in Israel. Next week, the clocks will be changed. There's nothing we can do about it. The confusion. And of course, at 1 p.m., 2 hours from now, Zev Elif will be giving his series on making Pesach American. He's a historian of American history. And he's going to be talking about planters, peanut oil and kitniot and Pesach and the historical changes that went on. But that's in a couple hours. And now, pleasure to introduce Rabbi Kowalski, who spent many, many years in, he grew up in New York, but spent many years in Baltimore. And they learned in Eretz Yisrael for many, many years. I know he was very close to Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg. It's a big Talmid Chacham, but practiced as a lawyer for, I don't know, 35, 40 years, Avram. I don't know exactly how long. Practiced as a lawyer, a long time. And he made Aliyah. I'm sorry?
Too long.
And I made Aliyah in 2013, and he gives many shirim, the OU Center around, and he learns and he writes. So it's a pleasure to have him, and we'll be talking about Yosef's final dream. Bakasha, Rav Avram.
Thank you very much. Okay, the first thing we all are familiar with this, I think. The rabbis tell us that the redemption from Egypt is a prototype for redemptions throughout Jewish history, whenever, and even the final redemption will be somehow, the experience from the emergence from Egypt is somehow a prototype for the ultimate redemption, which therefore causes us to want to study the redemption from Egypt to see how we can adapt it and extrapolate from it, that experience, to perhaps our own experience, which we should be zoche to to live through the coming of the Messiah in short order. Anyway, the Torah tells us l'man tisker es yom tzeischa mi'eretz Mitzrayim kol yemei chayecha. Perhaps that is the reason, one of the reasons, not the primary reason, but corollary reason that the Tzias Mitzrayim is to be remembered every day of our lives. We should remember that experience in order to draw from its lessons. And hopefully we will merit the great day when Hashem's name will be spread throughout the world and his knowledge will be spread. Kayom kamayim layam achasim, like the waters will cover the sea, all over there will be the knowledge of Hashem. Okay, so in order to accentuate this experience of the Yetzias Mitzrayim, and to also base my remarks on what I call Yosef's final dream, let us ask a series of questions. The Medrash tells us, and this is in source number one, Bizchus arba devarim nigalu avoseinu mimitzrayim, in the merit of four things were our ancestors redeemed from Egypt. Now,
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I may have missed it, and I apologize. I don't have your source sheet. So if you send it to me now, I just missed it. I'll try to post it. But in the meantime, if you want to share your screen, I apologize for that.
They're on the website. I took them.
Oh, off. They are on the website. Okay, I apologize. Happened. Okay, I will post it. Thank you very much. I apologize for that. If people do, I don't even know what goes on. Okay, I'm sorry.
I'm very thankful to Pesach Rogoy because I couldn't figure out to do what you just asked me to do. So that I am technologically handicapped, unfortunately. So I wouldn't have been able to do what you asked. So I'm very happy that we found them. All right. Anyway, the Medrash says, and that's in source one, that in the merit of four things did our ancestors achieve redemption from Egypt. Now, we're familiar with always quoting this Medrash as having said three things, but you'll see that there's four things. And in fact, as to the fourth of Zuchus, there is a difference of opinion among various Midrashim. Okay, so let's take a look at that Medrash. The Medrash says, Omar Rabbi Elazar HaKafar, v'zchus arba devarim nigalu avaseinu mimitzrayim, in the merit of four things our ancestors were redeemed from Egypt. Shaloshinu eshamam, they didn't change their names. Shaloshinu eslashonam, they didn't change their language. Bishalogolu mistarim, sholehem, they didn't reveal secrets. What does that mean, they didn't reveal secrets? When Hashem tells Moshe to instruct the children of Israel to borrow Klei Kesef, Klei Zov, Usmalos, utensils of silver, gold, and clothing from the Egyptians, the Jewish people did not reveal to the Egyptians that they were never coming back. So the Egyptians therefore extended these items to them as a loan. And had they told the Egyptians that they weren't going to come back, who knows how many of them would have made any loans to the Jewish people. And therefore, God would have been found short in his promise to Abraham that when the affliction of the experience in Egypt would end, they would go out with a great with wealth. How would God fulfill that? He wanted them to borrow these utensils. And if they weren't able to borrow them because they told the Egyptians they weren't coming back, God would have fallen short on that promise. So therefore, this is one of the things that warranted a merit. The differences of opinion is that this thing of Shelo Golu Nistaroso, that they didn't reveal secrets. Some say that the Medrash says Shelo Shinu Esmalbusham. They didn't change their manner of clothing. And that's the merit. And then finally, Shelo Hayu Prutzim by Arias, they were not promiscuous in any way, shape, or form. They didn't throw themselves at their Egyptian masters and try to curry favor through sexual offerings of their bodies, in a sense. So therefore, Lo Hayu Prutzim by Arias, they were not wanton in matters of sexual behavior. Now, we need to examine this medrash. Let's start. Okay, Shaloshinu Eshimam, Shaloshinu Eshoshonam, Shalogolo Nistaros, or Shaloshinu Esmalbusham, and Shalohayu Prutzim Barayas. Now we can understand and we can appreciate the great restraint that the Jewish slaves, the Israelite slaves, evidenced by not being wanton sexually, because that maintained family purity. Had they assimilated in a sense into the Egyptian culture and intermingled with them in a sexual fashion, their legitimacy and bona fides as descendants of Yaakov and Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov would have been called into question. So this is a very, very powerful thing that they, from their perspective, maintained their family purity. However, all of the other three things or four things that we talked about, they need to be examined. For the Medrash tells us that when the Jewish people were at the crossing of the sea, that the angels complained to Hashem and said, why are you saving these Jewish people? Halalu avdei avodah zarah, v'halalu avdei avodah zarah. Both the Jewish people are idolatrous, or let's say the Egyptians are idolators. The Jewish people are idolators. Our tradition is that the Jewish people sunk to the 49th level of impurity. And, we maintain that had they sunk to the 50th, they would never have been redeemed. So here we're talking about a people that went to the very depths, that they were down at the lowest rung possible before they would fall into an abyss from which they could never extract themselves. Or even God could not extract themselves because there was nothing spiritually worthy of redemption had they fallen into that last rung. So here we are, they're on the 49th rung. So what does it mean that they didn't change their names? They didn't change their clothing. They didn't change their language. Now, we all who have experienced the diaspora, unfortunately, we have witnessed many, many Yordim who have gone down from Eretz Yisrael into the diaspora, and they maintain their Jewish names, and we hear them speaking Hebrew, and we know that they're involved, God forbid, sometimes in drugs and in prostitution and in immoral behavior in terms of ethical moral behavior. People are afraid to deal with Israelis many times because of their business practices. So we know that there is, that maintaining your name and you're maintaining your language is no protection against spiritual descent. So what was this greatness that God says, or the Medrash says, in the name of Hashem, that these are the things that merited our redemption? So we may argue that these practices maintained their ethnic identity. That's how they maintained ethnic identity. They didn't change their names, their language, their clothing. But that's really not true. What maintained their ethnic identity? The yellow star they wore. That's what maintained their ethnic identity. And in this case, in Egypt, the fact that they were slaves. They couldn't decide one day to get up and walk like an Egyptian and talk like an Egyptian and dress like an Egyptian and walk out of their slavery and join the Egyptian society. The Egyptians kept them impressed, enslaved, indentured. They could not, they couldn't escape from themselves. They couldn't assimilate into the Egyptian culture and then say, okay, we're not going to be slaves anymore. We're going to deem ourselves Egyptians. We're Egyptian citizens. We are not Jewish slaves anymore because we speak Egyptian. We dress like an Egyptian and we have Egyptian names. Wouldn't have helped them. So they're maintaining their names and their language and their mode of dress did not protect their ethnic identity. The fact that they were slaves protected their ethnic identity. Similarly to what the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, did, they made the Jews wear yellow stars. The Jews didn't maintain their ethnic identity. The Nazis maintained their ethnic identity. And matter of fact, the Nazis even traced it back. If your great-grandfather was Jewish, you were considered Jewish. So even if a person was not halakhically a Jew, the Nazis deemed him a Jew. If a person was an Israelite in Egypt, the Egyptians maintained his identity because they wanted them to serve as slaves. So what is this? If these objects, Shaloshinu Neshonim, Malbushim, and Shemam, did not protect their spiritual values because they sunk to the lowest level, it did not protect their ethnic identities either. So what was the merit of these things? Why are these things deemed meritorious? And let's take the question even further. None of these factors enter into halacha. There's no halacha to maintain your name, a Hebrew name. There's no halacha to speak Lashon HaKodesh or Hebrew even. There's no halacha, there's no specific dress. despite what the Hasidim have adopted in the last, let's say, 200 years or so, or 250 years, there's no national mode of dress by the Jewish people. Yes, we have a klal, we have a principle that one should dress modestly, but there's no specific clothing style. A spodik, or a kapoto, or a gartel, or whatever you want to call it. There is no mode of Jewish dress that is mandated by halacha. And then let's take this question even further. Let's take a look at the Babylonian experience, where the Babylonian Talmud was written in Aramaic, not written in Hebrew. The scholars of the Talmud, Rav Abaye, Rav Mori, Rav Papa, Bar Poda, Mar Zutra, their names are all Aramaic names. They're not Hebrew names. So they did not maintain the language. They did not maintain the names. They did not maintain, their clothing because there was no clothing to maintain. And what is it? They didn't reveal secrets. What does that mean? So what is all this? What are we talking about? Why are these principles considered so meritorious that they were the reasons that we were benefited to have our redemption from Egypt? Okay, so that's really another question. That's all wrapped up in, I don't know how many questions that was, but let's put that aside. Those are questions. Let's go on with some more questions. Chazal tell us that in the final moments of the Jewish experience in Egypt, Moshe Rabbeinu, the great leader of the Jewish people, busied himself with the bones of Yosef HaTzadik, of Yosef's bones. And there's a whole story about how he extracted them from they were sunk in the bottom of the Nile. He extracted them with a holy name, whatever that medrash means. The point is, here's the commander in chief. He is rallying this rabble, a group of people that never had an organized, that never acted in any organized fashion. They're coming with their children, with their pianos, with their bathtubs, and they're schlepping everything to get out of Egypt. And you can just imagine the balagan and the And the children are crying, and the old people are saying, slow down. And this one's saying, I can't carry this. Help me. It was just one big balagan. And here's the commander in chief, the man who's in charge of organizing everything. And what's he doing? He's off looking for the bones of Yosef. Why didn't he delegate that? That's not something the leader should be doing. That's something, not even a lieutenant, maybe a captain or somebody lower. Why would Moshe Rabbeinu be busying himself at this very moment when his leadership traits were in great demand, and here he is looking for the bones of Yosef? Well, let's put that question aside, and let's go on to another question. At the end of the book of Yoshua, which is the first book of the Nevi'im Rishonim, the early prophets, so Yoshua ben Nun gathers the people of Israel to give his farewell address. He follows in the tradition first established by Moshe Rabbeinu to make a farewell address, which ultimately George Washington introduced to the American society. But let's go back to Moshe Rabbeinu gives a farewell address, which is basically a large part of Sefer Devarim. Yoshua ben Nun gathers the people in Shechem. Okay? He gathers the people in Shechem to give his farewell address. Now, who established the Mishkan in Shiloh? Well, Yoshua, of course, when the Jewish people crossed the Jordan, they transported the Mishkan. The Mishkan was portable. It could be disassembled and then reassembled. And so when the Jewish people crossed the Jordan River, they carried the Mishkan with them, and they first established it in Gilgal, which was their first resting place after they crossed the Jordan. And in Gilgal, it stood for 14 years. Those 7 years of war and 7 years of where Joshua divided the land amongst the Jewish people. Note that it took 7 years to conquer the 31 Canaanite city states, but it took 7 years to divide the land among the Jews. That was probably a much more difficult battle for Yoshua. But anyway, he divides the land in 7 years, total 14 years. And then he moves the Mishkan from Gilgal to Shiloh. And he sets it up on a foundation of stone, and there it remains for 369 years. Okay? So this is the center, the epicenter of the Jewish people, the Holy Tabernacle, with the Ark of the Covenant, with the Mishkan, with the Mizbeach, with the menorah, all of these things that were fashioned in the desert by Moshe with Bezalel and Eliyav, and he brings them to Shiloh, establishes it in Shiloh. This becomes the center of the religious center of the people. Why does he gather the nation in Shechem for his farewell address? Why does he not gather them in Shiloh? Like when the Jewish, once the Beis HaMikdash was built, all of the national assemblies were basically in Yerushalayim. You don't go somewhere else. You go to Yerushalayim. Why would he go to Shechem to make his farewell address specifically, since he was the one who set up the Mishkan in Shiloh? So that's a question. That's the next question also is derived from the end of the book of Yoshua. It says, and I think this is of source number 2, in Perek Chaf Dalid, Pasik Chaf Tes, in chapter 24, verse 29, which is all the way at the end of Sefer Yehoshua, it says, was after these things, this matter, what was the matter? The farewell address in Shechem. After Yehoshua concludes his farewell address, Vayomos Yehoshua ben Nun, Eved Hashem, ben Meah ve'Esher Shanim, and Joshua, the servant of God, passes away at the age of 110. Vayikbru also, and Timnas Serach, they bury him in Timnas Serach, which is in the portion of Ephraim. Vayavod Yisrael es Hashem kol yimei hazakenim esheharichu yomim achrei Yoshua. Yoshua's profound influence on the children of Israel endured, and it endured so that they served God faithfully all the days of the elders who were peers of Yehoshua, but who outlived him. So they still were able to maintain complete fidelity to Hashem. And then, all of a sudden, it tells us, V'es atzmos Yosef, and the bones of Yosef, asher helu b'nei Yisrael mi-Mitzrayim, kovru b'shechem. The bones of Yosef that were brought up from the Jewish people, brought up with them from Egypt, they interred them, they buried him in Shechem. Now, this is 28 years after Joshua crossed the Jordan, carrying the bones of Yosef. Do you mean to tell me that they did not bury Yosef for 28 years? They left him lying around in a coffin or whatever for 28 years? No. Of course they buried him much, much earlier. So what is this sentence, which is basically the concluding sentences of the book of Joshua, telling us that they buried Yosef 28 years after they crossed the Jordan? It makes no sense. So that's the next question. Okay, let's put that question aside. And let's go on to another question. See, you know, this Pesach, when you're sitting at the Seder, you can ask all these questions. But anyway, in Parshas Vayigash, the Torah records for us, and I want to apologize that I did not include this in the source sheet. But take my word for this. You can go to Parshas Vayigash. It's chapter 47 in the Torah in Genesis. And you will see there 14 sentences. The Torah spends 14 sentences telling us about how Yosef bartered with the Egyptians for food. Now, you know, there was a 7 years of plenty in which Yosef gathered all of the excess abundant produce from the years of plenty, stored them away, put them away because Yosef had foretold through the interpretation of Pharaoh's dream that immediately following the 7 years of plenty, there would be 7 years of famine. Okay? So now the 7 years of plenty are over. The people all gave their excess crops and foods to Yosef. He had them stored in storage warehouses. And now when the hunger struck, he's going to barter and exchange and sell that which was accumulated to the Egyptian people. So what does he do? First, we are told that the Egyptians paid for this excess food that they now needed because the famine had struck and they had no food. So they ended up exhausting all of their money. They basically spent all their money buying food. Then Yosef, they forced them to barter for the food in exchange for their livestock. When their stock of cattle was depleted, the people acquired food only by trade of their land holdings. They had to give up all their property, all of their land. And finally, after they gave up all their land, so they were no longer had money, they no longer had livestock, they no longer had real estate. Now they were forced to indenture themselves to the Pharaoh in order to obtain food. All this wealth was delivered into the royal coffers. Yosef didn't take it for himself. He gave it over to Pharaoh. And then the Torah tells us a very odd thing. Only the property of the priest was exempted. Yosef and his amassing of all of the wealth in exchange for food exempted the priest from having to pay for their food. Rak admasa koanim. Yosef did not take their property. And the Torah tells us this on two specific occasions. If you look in those 14 sentences, twice the Torah tells us the lands of the priests were exempted. So the question becomes as follows. Number one, why does the Torah spend 14 sentences telling us about how Yosef, the financial wizard for Pharaoh, did all of this in order to enrich the coffers of the king? And also, why do we care if the priests were exempt, the priests weren't exempt? Who cares? What does this have to do with the eternity of Israel? Why do we worry about the priests of the Egyptian priests? Okay. So let's put that question aside and go on to the next question. In the last sentence of Chumash Bereishis of the book of Genesis, the Torah tells us Vayomas, and this is in source number 3. Vayomas Yosef be'meir ve'eser shanim v'yisem ba'orom b'mitzrayim. And Yosef dies at the age of 110. Notice, Yosef and Yehoshua both lived for 110 years. And he dies at the age of 110, and he was placed in a coffin. We know that he was embalmed, but he was also placed in a coffin in Egypt. That's the end of the book of Genesis. In the sixth, in the first chapter of Shemos, in the sixth sentence, it says, Vayomas Yosef v'chol echav v'chol adorahu. And Yosef died with all his brothers and the entire generation. Now, obviously, Yosef did not die twice. He didn't die once in the book of Genesis and then somehow get resurrected and die again in the book of Shemos. He died once. But the Torah is telling us in two separate books that Yosef died. Now, this is not just that the Torah repeats itself, because sometimes the Torah may have some repetition. We would have to try to examine what the reason is, but let's just look at it even from a more profound vantage point. The book of Bereshis is the book of the patriarchal figures of civilization. Adam, Noah, Shem, Terach even, of Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Esav, Yishmael, all of these patriarchal figures are referenced in the book of Genesis. Zeh Sefer told us Adam, this is the book of the history of mankind, of civilization. These are the patriarchal figures of civilization. I don't mean to diminish the matriarchal persons. It tells us about Sarah and about Rivka and about Leah and about Rachel. The matriarchal figures are all mentioned in this book. Yocheved. So we're talking about the patriarchal figures. Yosef dies amongst the patriarchal figures. Then Yosef dies amongst his brethren in the second book, in the book of Exodus, Vayomas Yosef v'chol echav, and Yosef dies together with his brothers. So on one hand, he dies as a patriarchal figure, and on one hand, he dies as a chieftain of one of the tribes, together with his other brothers. So what is going on? All of these questions, how do we address them? Let's try to weave an answer that will tie this all together. So let's begin. So the first thing we've already sort of mentioned and hinted at, but let's accentuate it now. Yosef is a transitional figure. Yosef is a quasi-father and a quasi-chieftain of a tribe. He serves in two capacities. For after all, Yosef is the only one of the 12 sons who himself spawns two sons who become or are elevated to the status of tribes. Ephraim u'Menashe k'Ruven v'Shimon yuli, says Yaakov Avinu. I'm elevating Ephraim and Menashe to the status of Ruven and Shimon. Just like Ruven and Shimon are from the 12 tribes, so too are Ephraim and Menashe. How does that work out? Levi drops out from the count because he doesn't get a portion in the land. He serves God either in the tabernacle, the Mishkan, or ultimately in the Beis HaMikdash, or ultimately as a teacher among the 42 cities of the Levites. He does not get a portion in the land, and he, the tribe of Levi, is dedicated to the service of Hashem. And therefore, they are not counted as a tribe when the 12 tribes are counted in many things. For in their formation in the desert, Levi, the tribe of Levi, surrounds the Mishkan. It doesn't march in formation like the other 12 tribes. Ephraim and Manasseh are listed in Bamidbar as in formation as one of the 12 tribes. So therefore, Yosef is a father-like figure because he spawns two tribes. Just like Yaakov spawned 12, Yosef spawned two. That makes him a father figure. And then again, of course, he's also on the Choshen, on the breastplate that Aaron HaKohen wore. Yosef's name appears, not Ephraim and Manasseh. Yosef's name appears because then on the breastplate of the Kohen, he's considered a father of a tribe. So on one hand, he's patriarchal. On the other hand, he's tribal. So how do we understand Yosef being a patriarchal figure. So we already mentioned that he spawned two tribes, but that's not enough, because that would invest or inject Yosef's, let's call it, spiritual DNA into two tribes. But that doesn't make him a father of the nation. That makes him a father of two tribes. What does he inject into the nation that he gets this quasi-patriarchal status? What was his contribution to Am Yisrael, to Klal Yisrael, that merits him to be considered a father in Israel and dying amongst the patriarchs? So we all know that we, in our tradition, view Yosef as the father of the Jewish diaspora. He was the first to, so to speak, Jew, let's call him an Israelite, to be separated from the family, to go down into the diaspora, to live alone for many years, all by himself with his, I guess, with his family, but basically cut off from the Jewish people, cut off from the land of Israel, Canaan, living amongst the Gentiles, flourishing amongst the Gentiles, and yet maintaining his deep-rooted sense of belief in one God and whatever, and Bris Mila and other things that were patriarchal in observance. He's considered the father of the Golis, of the diaspora. Now, and of course, that is a very, very, very important factor that he injects into our people, the ability to survive when we're surrounded by a foreign culture, where we're surrounded by people that are pagan and idolatrous in those days. And that, just the mere fact that he survived, was something that he injected into the Jewish people. But how did he do this? How does it transfer from Yosef into the Jewish people? So if you take a look again, and this is in source number 4. In source number 4, we see that Yosef invoked a solemn oath. It says, Vayashba Yosef es b'nei Yisrael, and Yosef imparted or invoked a solemn oath with the children of Israel. And he said to them, Pokod yivkod Elokim eschem, God will certainly remember you, v'halisem es atzmosai mizeh itchem, it's cut off, and you should take up or carry up my bones with you on the way to Israel. Okay? So what did Yosef impart to the Jewish people? The promise, the godly promise, that we, the Jewish people, would be redeemed from, the hardships and the bondage and the travail that afflicted us in Egypt. We will get redemption. This is what the Jewish people, this is what the Jewish people remembered. How do we know the Jewish people remembered this? Because we know from the experience of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu grew up in the house of Paro. He was adopted by the princess and saved by the princess. And therefore she merited to call him Moshe, which is the name the Torah, it stuck with him even in the Torah. His parents gave him different names. The Medrash has a whole suggestion of names that his parents gave him, but those names faded into oblivion, and the name Moshe stuck with Moses, with Moshe Rabbeinu. By the way, there's a very interesting nitziv that says, what does Moshe mean? Moshe does not mean ki min hamayim hishisihu, that I drew him out of the water, because if the princess went around in the palace and kept telling everybody, oh, I drew him out of the water, and therefore I called him Moses, they would have killed him, because they would have figured he was a Jewish baby, and Paro gave a decree, every Jewish baby to be drowned. So they would have taken him and drowned him. So she didn't call him Moshe, meaning I drew him out of the water. Says in the Tziv that in ancient Egyptian, some Sfardi Chacham told him that Moshe means Moses, or Mose means my son. She called him my son. In fact, Umberto Casuto preceded the Nitziv, or maybe he was a contemporary of the Nitziv, and he says the same thing, that Moshe does not mean I drew him out of the water, but Moshe means my son. Anyway, Moshe grew up in the palace of Paro. It says in the pasuk, "Vayigdal Moshe vayetze alechav," and Moshe grew up or matured, and he went out to see the plight of his brethren. Now, how old was he when he was matured? Vayigdal. So we have two standards in the Torah of maturity. One is 13, one is 20. Okay, we can either assume that Moshe was 13 when he first went out to see, to discover the plight of his people, or he was 20. Let's assume for argument's sake that he was 20. Okay, why will I assume that? Because it'll play into the next point. When does he come back? He's 80 years old when he walks out of the desert and returns to Egypt. He's forced to run away the second day after the second day of identifying as a Jew. The first day he strikes dead the Egyptian who was beating a Jew. The next day he tries to break up a fight amongst two Jews who then say to him, "Are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian?" And he goes, "Achein noda hadavar, oh my goodness. I was spotted, I was observed when I struck the Egyptian," and he ran for his life. So he's 20 when he leaves Egypt, running for his life. He comes back, he's 80. He's gone for 60 years. He walks out of the desert and he says, "I'm the Redeemer." People look at him and say, "Are you for real? What do you mean you're the Redeemer? Where have you been for 60 years? Who are you? What are you? Who sent you here?" In other words, what did he do to affirm their belief in his mission? He said, "Pokod yivkod Elokim eschem." He, if you take a look in Shemos, you will see that Moshe Rabbeinu invokes that formula when he comes to identify himself to the Jewish people. That promise or that oath that Yosef imparted to the Jewish people was what they remembered. That's what gave Moshe his legitimacy, at least his initial legitimacy. And that's why they believed in him right away, because they remembered that oath that Yosef imparted to them. So when we ask a question, what did Yosef impart to the Jewish nation as opposed to just two tribes? He imparted the hope, the promise of redemption. That hope and promise of redemption is what enabled the Jewish people to survive the gruesome ordeal of the horrific bondage that they were subjected to under the Egyptian overlords and masters. Without that, they would have been crushed. That's what happens when you have no faith, when you have not only religious faith, but when you have no faith in the future. If you don't have any dream that you hope is going to become a reality and you are facing a terrible, a crushing experience, you do not survive. You get destroyed emotionally, if not mentally, and then you cannot resurrect yourself from that terrible abyss that you fall into. And that's what Yosef imparted to the Jewish people, the trust and the faith and the hope of redemption. And therefore, he is a father figure. This was a strong belief formula that he injected into our people. And the truth of the matter is, that's why he's the father of the diaspora, because this too sustained us. All those 2,000 approximately years that we were in the exile until this, last two generations that we had the great merit to return to the promised land. What sustained our people for 1900 plus years? The faith. Animamim be'amuna shalema, we believed with true faith that we were going to be redeemed, that the long exile would come to an end, that the Messiah would come, and if not the Messiah himself, that we would begin to hear and feel the footsteps of the Messiah. When God turns his face back to our people and led us into our redemption and the establishment of the state of Israel. This is what gave us the strength, this belief that it would happen. And therefore, we survived the long, long, long gullus. And that's what Yosef gave to our people. Now, how did he give this to our people? They forgot Bris Milah. They forgot even that we have one God in the belief in one God. They forgot all these things. They sunk to the terrible levels of depravity of the Egyptian people with their belief in pagan beliefs. What gave them the ability to remember the promise of Yosef? Shaloshinu es shamam Shaloshinu es Lashonam, Shaloshinu es Malbusham. Why didn't they change their names? Well, we're going home. We're only here temporarily. If we're only here temporarily, we have to maintain our original names, our original language, our religion, our original methodology of dress, whatever that may have been. And therefore, if we use these things to keep us, keep alive the fact or the notion that we are going to be redeemed, the hope that we are going to be redeemed, therefore we don't change any of these things. So what the Midrash is telling us is because we believed in the redemption and we kept that hope alive, we merited redemption. It's not that we got, you know, a big, a gold star. You know, oh, we have now all these points because we remembered these things. No, it was that these things kept alive the promise of redemption. That promise sustained us. That promise is what led to our redemption. Had we not protected that promise, that oath, had we not protected it, had we not maintained it, we would have been assimilated and lost in oblivion, sunk into the Egyptian morass of which we never would have been redeemed. So now we begin to understand these things led to the protection of the promise. Now, how did they know? We asked the question. How did they know to adopt these things? Where did they get this from? So I'm going to tell you, in my opinion, they modeled these things after Yosef himself. So let's take each one of these things. Let's take Shaloshinu Eshamam. They didn't change their names. Now, we know that when Yosef rose up in the eyes of Paro, and Paro installed him, let's call him, as his prime minister, his second in command, the chancellor, whatever else, whatever title you want to give him, Paro said to him, you know, I'm going to call you Tzafnas Paneach, which means revealer of the hidden, because you revealed to us, through the Egyptian people, the future of the famine and the way to protect ourselves from the famine. So you are a revealer of the future. Therefore, you're going to have a name, whatever the Egyptian equivalent is of Tzafnas Paneach. Okay? And if Ruthie Shane is listening, she has a great chiddush in this. If you ever want to hear her give a little, a lecture on what the Tzafnas Paneach mean, it's very, very worthwhile to hear her pshat, her explanation. But even so, Paro gave him an Egyptian name, bottom line. What does Yosef do 3 or 4 sentences later? He calls his sons Menashe ki Menashani Elokim. He calls his son Ephraim ki Ephrani Elokim. He gives them Hebrew names. He doesn't give them Egyptian names, notwithstanding the fact that Paro told him, abandon your Hebrew name, adopt the name Tzafnas Paneach. We'll no longer call you Yosef. We're going to call you Tzafnas Paneach. But Yosef doesn't succumb to that. He decides that he's going to retain the Hebrew names to his sons. So therefore, when the Jewish people were modeling themselves after Yosef in order to protect the promise and the hope and the anticipation of redemption, they don't change their names. Now they don't change their language. How did they know not to change their language? Well, when Yosef is talking to his brothers and accusing them of being spies, the brothers start mumbling among themselves and saying, oh my goodness, you know why this is all happening to us? We did not hear the cry of our brother, B'hishchananu Eleinu, when he cried out to us from the pit and he begged us not to do this to him. That's why this is happening to us. We were deaf to his pleas and now it's coming full circle to haunt us. We are being accused. We accused him. Now we're being accused. And look what's happening to us. And Yosef has to excuse himself. And he starts to cry. He goes to private quarters and he cries. How did Yosef know what they were saying? Because he knew Hebrew, of course. He knew Lashon HaKodesh. But then how did he converse with them? So it says, below Yadu, they didn't know that Yosef understood them because Hamelitz Beinosam, there was an interpreter that interpreted between them, between the brothers, and between Yosef. And this interpreter knew Hebrew. Says Rashi, who is this interpreter? The answer Rashi gives us, it's Menashe, the son of Yosef. Yosef taught his sons Hebrew. How did he teach his sons Hebrew? Because at home they spoke Hebrew. So therefore, they said, Shaloshinu es Lashonam. We learn from Yosef that we do not change our language. Okay. How do they know that they don't, that they should keep their mode of dress? So when Yosef reveals himself to his brothers, he decides, he tells them, go back and bring down Papa. Bring down our father. Is Yaakov still alive? Please hurry up home. Al tirgizu baderach. Do not delay. You know, do not shmai around. Don't go sightseeing. Go straight home and bring our aging father down to Egypt. Right? So what does he say? And don't worry about bringing your pianos and your big, your furniture. He, Kuv kol ha'aretz lefanecha. I will give you everything you need. I will give you food. I will give you furniture. I will give you a place to live. I will give you everything. And you don't have to bring anything back with you. Everything will be here. Hey, by the way, here's suits of clothing. Schlep them to Canaan and then schlep them back down here again. What do they need suits of clothing for? He just told them, I'm going to give you everything. I'm going to supply you with all your needs. Why would he have to tell them to take these clothes back up to Canaan and then bring them back down again? A useless task, a useless gift. Just to what? I don't know if they had the 50-pound weight limit in their suitcases, but why would he want them to carry all this up to Canaan and then have to bring it back down again? You know what he said? You know what the mode of dress of the Egyptians, the men of the Egyptian people, how did they dress? They wore breeches from their knee to their waist. He said, I'm not going to be able to convince Yaakov Avinu to come down to Egypt if everyone's going to dress like the Egyptians. He's not going to want to come and be so immodest in his clothing. Therefore, send him up this clothing and show him the royal clothing that I will provide. And convince him that this will be the mode of dress of our family in this land. I, the chancellor, am giving him this mode, this style and this dress. This is the dress they will wear. This is the clothing they will wear. And therefore, he gave them clothing. Shaloshinu es malbusham. They didn't change their clothing. How do we know shalogolu nistaros? That they did not, where did they learn not to reveal secrets? So when Yosef reveals himself to his brothers, it says in the pasuk, Vahakol nishma beis paro bo'u ache Yosef. The rumor went out. The voice was heard. People began to talk. You know who came to Egypt? The 10 brothers of Yosef, or the 11 at that point. The brothers of Yosef are here. Now, that was like an astounding revelation to them. Whoa, you know who these 11 strangers are? They're none other than the brothers of Yosef. But they should have figured this out themselves. Here comes 10 people down. If they knew the story that Yosef was jumped by his brothers, stripped of his multicolored garment, thrown into a pit, extracted from the pit, sold into slavery, and now he's the chancellor of Egypt, and along come 10 strangers from Canaan, and all of a sudden, he accuses them of being spies. Why would he accuse them of being spies? They had no FBI report on them. Why would they be considered spies? What made him think they were spies? And his security chief must have said to him, we have no evidence of them being spies. Why do you say they're spies? They're spies, he tells them. Then he says, you know what? Take the money that they paid for their produce and put it back in their saddlebags. What is it with this man? His staff must have been saying, what is he doing? Putting the money back. From us, he took everything. From these 10 strangers, he's giving them back their money? What's going on here? Okay. Next time they come down, they want to bring the money back. So what does Paro say? No, that's not the money that you paid me. I don't know where that money came from. God gave you that money. They're saying, what is he talking about? He instructed us to put the money back there. Then he says, take my goblet and put it in the, and take all the money that they paid for their second time down for all the food, put that all in their saddlebags, and take my goblet and put it in the saddleback of the youngest son, the youngest brother. Now they're going to say to themselves, what in the world is he doing? Then he goes out and accuses them of stealing it. Why is he framing them? What's he doing with these people? Why is he tormenting them? If they knew the story that Yosef's brothers sold him into slavery, they would have said, ah, we know what he's doing. He's taking revenge on his brothers. He's going to sock it to them because of what they did to him. But they didn't know. And that's why they were bewildered. And that's why they were in shock when they said, oh, Ba'akol Nishma Beis Yosef Bo Achi Yosef. The word got out that these are Yosef's brothers. They would have easily figured this out by themselves if Yosef had told them the story. But we see from here that Yosef never told them his history of how he became a slave. And therefore, they learned not to reveal secrets so that when they left Egypt, they could enable HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in a sense, you might say, to fulfill his promise that they would not have any, they would have wealth at the end of their, at the end of their sojourn in Egypt. So all of these things that they adopted because they modeled themselves after Yosef was to protect the oath, the solemn oath of Pokod Yivkod Elokim Eschem. And that's what gave them the strength to survive the terrible bondage. And that's what also merited that they should become, they should be redeemed by Hashem. Okay, now we ask the question. Why, by the way, just notice this. There was 7 years of plenty and then 2 years of famine. At the end of the second year of famine, Yaakov comes down to Egypt, and our Midrash, the Midrash tells us the famine ended. When Yaakov entered Egypt, in the schus of Yaakov Avinu, there were the last 5 years of the famine ended. There was only really 2 years of famine. So now let us think. Yosef is our father. He's implanted us how to survive in the gullus and to never lose faith in redemption, to always have hope, and that hope sustains us. There's another thing that Yosef implanted to us, and that is a negative trait that he demonstrated, and that too we learn from our ancestors. Now, you know that there's a very famous comment of Rav Shamsham of Phil Hirsch on when it says Vayigdalu ha-Ne'orim, when that Yitzchak raised the twins, Yaakov and Esav, he treated them equally. And Rav Shamsham of Phil Hirsch says he violated Chanoch Lenara Pidarko. You have to teach each son, you have to teach each of your children, sons and daughters, in accordance with their strength. You have to assess, you know, their acumen. You have to assess their, you know, you have to see if they're, if they have attention deficit. You have to see if they are, highly strung. You have to do a total assessment of your children so that you can teach them in the method that's most appropriate. And Yitzchak did not do that for whatever reason. And therefore, Rav Shamsham of Phil Hirsch is critical of Yitzchak. And what does he say this for? So we should learn how to act properly. The Gemara says, "La'olam al yishana adam b'banav bein abonim." You should never treat one child demonstratively better than you treat your other children, because that engenders jealousy. And because of that jealousy, niskalgulu avoseinu l'mitzrayim. We ended up being catapulted down into Egypt because Yaakov Avinu favored Yosef with the multicolored garment. So we learn negative things from our ancestors too. So let's ask this question. How is it possible that Yosef saved the entire population of Egypt from starvation? Okay. Malnutrition. Okay. Their children would have been, who knows, deformed and wasted away had they not have food. And then, you know, within a short period thereafter, they're drowning infants. They're drowning infants. It's terrible. I mean, you know how callous you have to be. Not just callous, you know how much hatred you have for the children of Israel to drown infant babies? Where did they get this hatred from? So now let's go back to this parsha of Vayigash, and let's re-examine those 16 sentences. And let us ask a question. Would Avram Avinu have sold food to people who came down the pike, you know, straggling coming out of the desert, walking on these highways, you know, thirsty, hungry, tired? Would he have said, okay, how much money do you have? Let me have all your money. Oh, you don't have any money? I'll take your camel. You don't have any camel? I'll take whatever else you had. Would Avram Avinu have treated people this way? What is Yosef doing? In 2 years, he stripped these people of everything they held valuable. Their money, their livestock, their land, their persons. And he did it with, must have been exorbitant prices. And don't forget, where did he get the food from? He took it from them. They grew the food. They had this abundant food. He collects it from them. And then he sells it back to them at this exorbitant prices. Says the Torah, learn from what Yaakov Avinu did. And that will teach you an understanding of what Yosef did. I'm sorry. Learn from Yosef did. How he mistreated the people. How he did it all in the name of the Pharaoh. What happened to the Jews in the Middle Ages? We served the feudal lords. We were the tax collectors. You know, the historian Gretz writes, how did the Chalmoniki massacre come about? Because the Jews were the tax collectors against the Ukrainians in those days. They forced them to pay the exorbitant taxes of the Polish feudal lords. They served the feudal lords. And what happens? The populace turns on us. And that's a lesson that we didn't learn. A bitter lesson that we did not learn throughout Jewish history. And the Torah was warning us about this. And that's why it's been 14 sentences telling us about what Yosef did. Not only that, but the Torah wants us to learn what not to do. And therefore, it taught us these things. That's what you do not do if you don't. And, whoa, one more little point. What did we do? Of course, we served the feudal lords. And we bribe the priests. We bribe the priests. One of the keenest that we recite on Tisha B'Av is the story of, I forget what community, somewhere in Saxe-Lorraine, that went into the bishop's castle in order to seek protection from the crusaders. Why did they go to the bishop's castle? Because they had been bribing him. But he sold them out. Says the Torah, Rak ad masa kohanim. Yosef exempted the kohanim. Now let's get to another question. How long comes Moshe, takes his staff, throws it down in front of Paro, and it turns into snakes? And then there's this great battle. Who is more powerful? The gods, multiple gods of the Egyptians, or the God of Israel? The invisible incorporeal God of Israel versus the gods of Egypt. Ra, chief god, other gods that they had, Baal Zephon, whatever they had, these gods. Who would you think Paro would bandy out to engage Moshe Rabbeinu in this ideological battle of the God of Israel versus the gods of the Egyptians? You would think he would produce his priests. The priests that were exempt from paying taxes. These are the upper class of Egyptian society. They still had their wealth. They still were free. Why doesn't he bandy out his priests? This is a spiritual ideological battle. The answer is the people hated the priests because the priests were exempt from Yosef's decrees. So there was a resentment to the priests. You want to challenge the Israelites and the God of Israel? You don't produce your priests. The people resented the priests just like they resented and hated the Jews, the Israelites, because the Israelites stripped them of their dignity, stripped them of their property, took everything away from them, although it was only one person. We know that from anti-Semitic reactions all throughout history. One or two or five or 10 or whatever it is, Jews hurt them and they turn on the entire people. That's what happened in Egypt. They turned on us because of Yosef's stripping them of their dignity, reducing them to slavery. and therefore they turned on the Jews. And don't rely, says the Torah, on the priests. They will not be there to help you. And the feudal lords will not be able to help you when the populace turns against you. Do not demean and harm the populace in pursuit of currying favor from the feudal lords, from Paro. And that's the story of Yosef's final lesson to the Jewish people. So while his final dream was of redemption, and why he embodied into the body politic of Israel the hope and trust of redemption, he also tried to warn us against the egregious behavior that our people unfortunately did not learn that lesson in the Middle Ages in Jewish history. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Arvs, for your original idea. Okay. I don't know if you quickly want to take a look at the questions in the chat box.
Yeah, let's go. Show me the questions in the chat box.
Here, I'll if you want, I can read them to you if that's easier for you. Bones of Joseph represents promises made to prior generations.
That's why Moshe directed his attention to Yosef, because of Yosef, he could walk out of the desert after 60 years and claim to be the Redeemer and get the faith and trust of the people.
Okay. Shechem, of course, again, the connection to Yosef.
And that's why the bones of Yosef are mentioned at the end. So we should know that Joshua assembled the people in Shechem because he did not finish the job of ridding the countryside of the Canaanite nations. They remained pockets of Canaanites all the way to the building of this temple, almost 500 years later. And that's what Yahushua wanted to teach us. Remember, you're going to live amongst idolatrous pagans. Do not learn from them. And therefore, he assembled them in Shechem. And therefore, it mentions the interment of Yosef's bones to make sure we understand why he took them to Shechem.
Okay. Ruth saying Kavru, yeah, Shema Kavru means they had already buried him.
First mentioned.
I don't know if Kavru always means that, I'm not a Hebrew grammarian to know.
I just tell you it could be past tense, but it's telling you that what happened in the past, it's not at first telling you in the last sentences of the book of Yoshua. For sure he was buried earlier.
Okay, would the Egyptians, that's an interesting question, would the Egyptians have allowed the Jews to use Egyptians' name or even dress? It would have been, because that's what you were saying, they forced them. It was the Egyptians who maintained their Jewish identity, not us, okay? When did Hebrew develop? Okay, that's, I think, beyond our little class now, right?
It was the original language, but let's not get into it.
The word was correct. That's what I said. Not for now. Basara mamarot nivra olam. We assume that's in Hebrew. Okay. I mean, by what you're saying, you're basically giving a critique of Yosef at the end. It's the same thing. He gave Paro all the power in the world. I mean, that's how Paro could easily do it because he concentrated. That's why Paro loved Yosef's interpretation of the dream.
I see somebody asking that the Egyptian priests were a privileged caste long before Yosef came along. True. But what is the Torah telling us that they were exempted from this bartering system? What do we care? Don't mention the priests that they were, they weren't. It makes no difference. It's to tell us that we cannot rely on the church, on the religious figures to save us when push comes to shove. When things are deep, when we're in deep trouble with the populace, the priests and the church will never come to our aid. And that's why the Torah mentions it.
I'm just saying that's a powerful message, of course, for religious leaders should never, take advantage of situations that other people don't get. By the way, it is interesting. I don't know what it is in Europe, but in Canada, the United States, rabbis can claim, parsonage and all those things. I don't know if that creates any resentment. I don't know if people know that, but that's sort of a cute example of, I know cute may be the wrong word, but... That's a simple example. There are wrong
serious examples. Yosef at Tzadik.
Yeah, Yosef at Tzadik, but ain't Tzadik Bar, it's a Shelo Yechta, if I can.
Okay, well, listen, Yitzchak was a tzaddik too, by Yidul Hanorim. Yaakov was a tzaddik too, and he was Mishana Bebonov Merabonim. We're not talking about Roshoyim, we're talking about tzaddikim, but they can make a mistake sometimes in a policy. And we're not talking about
that mistake.
We're not talking about, we didn't keep Shabbos or we didn't eat kosher. We're talking about practical lessons for life that he made a mistake in.
Mm-hmm. Moshe made mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. At least that's, at least in our world, I think we admit those things. That really is one of the differences between how our world, what I'll say, you know, I think people here, read Tanakh, and how other Jews read the Tanakh, where they will never ascribe any mistakes. And I'll just, well, then, as Rav Lichtenstein said, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, I remember he told us when I was in a shir, if you read the Chumash like that, that Avram and Yitzchak never made mistakes and everything, then we can't relate to them. Why am I reading their stories? They weren't human beings. They were great human beings, and they made mistakes, and some of those mistakes had terrible consequences. The great people make mistakes. The stakes are very high. Anyways, Avram, wonderful as always. We look forward to next week. Next Monday in about 54 minutes, Zabella will be talking on peanut oil. The Pascal peanut oil. What can I tell you? Who cares about Yosef? I want to eat. What was the fight? A few quinoa. I want quinoa and Pesach. That quinoa. So he's going to be giving sushi. You know, all the things, right? So he'll be discussing basically development.
I have to go to my granddaughter.
I can mute everybody. Okay. Anyways, that's a 1 o'clock. Everybody, I'm sorry.
Rabbi Kowalski.
An hour later.
Rabbi Kowalski, I wanted to tell you that I knew your father very, very well, Alav HaShalom. We were Kew Garden Hills, and you guys were Hillcrest. And he was very close with my parents, Mark, Eugene, and Jean Gluck. And I heard you a lot at the OU building maybe 8 years ago. We enjoyed the class very much. Thank you.
Very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Bakasha. We'll see you soon. Of course, Mark Shapiro's class tonight at 8:30. We're ongoing class, The Rise of Rabbinic Response to Reform. Tomorrow, Rachel Sharansky. It's not officially part of the Pesach series here, but continuing talking the ins and outs of freedom, Sefer Shmot, and then Alex Israel and Eliyahu. And then we continue Wednesday. Ari Mermelstein will be giving a series on Pesach also. And we look forward to learning with you. And invite a friend, as I always say, and we can see you in 52 minutes. Okay. I think I will turn off. Thank
Rabbi.
You. Thank you, Rabbi. And all the best.
Thank you very much.
Right. Yeah, I'll be giving my shiur on Friday morning. All the regular shiur will be
Friday morning, Yasha Koach. It was very lovely.